Ahoy, Mets fans. Welcome to episode 295 of Maison Avenue Audio, the official podcast of your SB Nation New York Mets site, Maison Avenue. My name is Brian Salvatore. Thank you for joining us this week. We are graced by the presence of Chris McShane, who hasn't been on the show in quite some time, and it's great to have Chris back. Chris and I talk about David Wright, and I guess about David Wright. No, there are other things too. But I think that the David Wright conversations are going to continue for the next few weeks. So strap in, folks, and here we go. Well, welcome back, Chris. Nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you.
In a bit. We got a lot to talk about, but let's just start with a pretty simple question for you, my friend.
Sure.
If you had to put the odds, well, let's set the line at 30. Okay. Will David Wright get 30 at bats in the majors this year? Yes or no?
I will say yes, and I feel like I should have taken notes, not necessarily in the context of the podcast or the site, but just conversationally with Mets fans over the last couple of years. I should have taken notes on some bets that I bet that he would return at all.
Right.
So I feel like I've got some beers that I need to cash in on. I just don't know who owes them to me.
Yeah.
It hasn't happened yet, but it sure seems like he's going to return, even if it's very brief. It seems like he will be back on a major league field.
Yeah, Allison and I talked a lot about this last week on the show, but I think we're gonna have to see Wright start four or five games at Citi Field down the stretch. That just seems like the Mets are gonna want to get him out there as often as they can, and I think that he might even be. See, part of if he didn't have the debilitating back injury and he was just washed up in a different way, I would say they're going to like make him pinch hit every game just so that people, when they come to the ballpark this, at the end of the season, they'll see David Wright. But I don't know if he's able to do that with his current back situation.
Right.
So it's going to be tricky trying to get out to Citi Field specifically to see David Wright. I wonder how far in advance they're going to post that schedule and if he's going to be able to keep a schedule if they do have something like that.
Right. Yeah. That's, I guess in a way for them, it kind of, it might be good. Ideally, you want people to not be disappointed, but you might create this sort of general, hey, I got to try to see David Wright,
right.
And Saturday looks good for me, so I'm going to go. And I understand that it's like a 50% chance, yeah. But
I remember going to a Yankee game in the last game of the season of Don Mattingly's last season as a Yankee. And by this point, his back was also destroyed by spinal stenosis, and he was the on deck batter when someone struck out to end the game. It just felt so anticlimactic. Maybe it was the season. Maybe he played a couple of games in the next season. I can't recall exactly. But I just remember it was at the tail end of his career, and everybody was there just to see Donnie Baseball one more time, and it didn't work out. And I just hope that the Mets have the foresight to, if Wright is healthy, to let him play as much as he can.
Yeah.
To give the fans that.
Right. Absolutely.
To hit, he's worked far harder than most people in his position would have worked to get back.
Oh, for sure.
So he deserves this too.
And I'd like to think that even people who have been, and I think sometimes we might pay a little bit too much attention to a very vocal minority of Mets fans. It's, when you go to a game and you're sitting in a section that has a few hundred people in it, and there's one loud guy who's yelling at him to retire, that it might come off as an overrepresentation of the percentage of Mets fans that have had that sort of anger toward him. Of course, I say this, and I've gone to like a record low number of games this year, and David Wright hasn't been, even in the ballpark for probably most or all the games I've been to. So maybe it's going on in a way, that that I'm just not seeing. But my point is, even the people who have been expressing that anger and, you know, yelling bad things at him, who I judge immediately when they say these things, I'd like to think that even they could look at it, you know, this September as, hey, you know, this sucks. It's sad that, you know, the last couple, 2-3 years really have gone the way they have, but you are the best position player who's ever played for this team. Yeah. And you're a Met throughout your career. You know, I mean, we know now that David Wright will never play for another team.
Yeah.
You know, so I'd like to think that, you know, if there's some kind of event, especially if he makes it back and he plays, you know, let's say he comes back on the 7th, which I think is the expectation now for everybody. You know, say he comes back and plays 2 games, a couple days off, 2 more games, a couple days off, and he gets into a spot. If he decides, you know what, this is, I accomplished this, I gave it my best shot, and, you know, where I'm at right now, I'm going to say this season is it. If that happens, that last game at Citi Field should be just a three and a half, 4 hour long tribute to David Wright, with, I would hope, a packed ballpark and a very loud, you know, crowd throughout.
Yeah. They would probably, the classy thing to do is what Willie Randolph did for Piazza, which, if you recall, he sent him out there in the top of the inning, and then before the first batter pulled him out. And so he was on the field and able to acknowledge the fans, you know, as they cheered him off. And so you would hope that they would do something similar for Wright. I think I asked this question of Allison, but I'll ask it of you as well. Is Wright going to be the first number they retire that isn't a Hall of Famer? It should be.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No. Well, I guess the short answer is yes. I'm just going to, in the fantasy land, I'm going to hold out hope that the Hall of Fame starts saying, hey, guys who had terrible injuries that ended their careers early, but were Hall of Fame worthy until that point, maybe we'll put them in. But barring a philosophy change on that subject, then yeah, nobody can wear number 5 again. Like, no way. They have to do it. They're dense. They're so dense. But, and especially when it comes to their own history and celebrating, like, it's weird to me that, like, I don't know how to put this. I guess the Yankees have had so much history of, you know, winning championships, being competitive even when they don't win them. It would almost be easy to get kind of lost in that and, you know, not necessarily take it for granted, but they hammer on it a lot. So to contrast, you know, the Mets don't have that many iconic teams. So it seems to me it should be really easy to celebrate the ones they have.
Right.
Teams, and they've had more great players than great seasons, of course. Right. But yeah, it doesn't seem that hard to get it right. And
what's insane to me is, like you said, so the Yankees are at a place where sooner than later they're going to run out of numbers because they've retired so many, right? The Mets are in no such danger. But you'd think that they've made it to the World Series now. Is it 5 times?
69, 73,
86. 2000, and then 15. You'd think just if you retire one player who's not Seaver or Piazza from each of those 5 championship teams while they're still alive, what's the harm in that?
Right.
Like, honestly, you don't think that that Jerry Kuzman did enough as a Met to have his number retired? You don't think, that Keith Hernandez did enough as a Met to have his number retired?
Right.
Come on. It's just insane to me. And David Wright should be that 2015 player.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no question.
Even if you want to go back and say that the 06 team, you know, should... Because what's going to happen here, and this is classic Mets, and I definitely talked about this in the podcast before, so I'm sorry, devoted listeners. What's going to happen is they're not going to retire Wright's number, and then Beltran's going to go in as a Met, and they're going to have to retire Beltran's number before Wright's number, and everyone's fucking head will explode.
Yeah.
The Mets.
Yeah. I'd like to be proven wrong.
Yes.
But they'll find a way to mess it up.
Of course they will. So even though we might see David Wright in September, we're not going to be seeing Peter Alonso, who was announced yesterday, I believe, that the Mets said they will not be calling him up in September. Now, if I squint hard enough, I kind of can understand why this is happening. You have enough guys on that team who can play first base, comma, should play first base, comma, should only play first base, right? Like, I understand that between Wilmer Flores and Jay Bruce and Dom Smith and maybe David Wright, and possibly Todd Frazier if David Wright's playing third base. Like, there are plenty of people who first base is their optimal position right now. But of all those people I just mentioned, the only person who I think has a legitimate chance of being the everyday first baseman in 2020 or 2021 is Pete Alonso. So wouldn't you want to get a look at him in the majors now and see how he handles himself? Doesn't that seem to make logical sense?
Yeah, the combination of getting that assessment and also just getting those, you know, first 100, maybe not even, given the, you know, state of the roster, maybe not even 100, but whatever, 100-ish plate appearances out of the way.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think anybody other than some people in the Mets front office think that the Mets are going to be good in 2019. But if you think they are going to be good in 2019, you know, why do you want to find out in the middle of April or May, depending on which service time manipulation they decide to go with? You know, why do you want to find out then if Alonso could be your guy at first base, you know?
Yeah.
Because with Cespedes out and this team being highly unlikely to spend a lot of money. Honestly, even if they do spend a lot of money, I think the odds are pretty high that they could go into the start of the season saying, you know, the starting outfield is Conforto, Nimmo, and Bruce. And, you know, defense hasn't really been a priority. And given the state of the roster, you know, they could roll in and put those three in the outfield and have Alonso at first, and there's at least a not too crazy scenario or outcome where, you know, the offense is really good from those positions. But yeah, I don't get it. You know, a team that needs young players to contribute in a major way can't really afford to worry about, you know, service time down the road. In Alonso's case, it's not even really a huge issue with that if you do it now. I'd much rather, you know, have him practice against the best level of competition there is, because that's what the rest of the season is for everybody. It's practice.
Yeah, exactly. It just,
they can spoil some playoff hopes for other teams, and I appreciate that. And there are definitely some games that I want them to win for that reason. But, you know, this is practice and evaluation, and, you know, Jason Vargas probably being amazing for September, so they hold on to him tight for next year.
Yeah. Again, tune into last week's show for a discussion of all things Vargy.
Yes. Yeah.
But, you know, it's This is my big problem, that I just don't understand why you wouldn't treat the rest of this season as purely scientific. You know, even someone like David Wright. Look, if Wright comes back, I am firmly of the belief that Wright's going to retire at the end of this season. Firmly of that belief. But if he comes back and he gets into a routine and you find out that Wright could be a two-day-a-week starter or a decent bench piece, that's good information to have.
Yeah.
There's no downside to just trying everything right now. And that's the only reason I'm not really pissed at the "we want Bruce to play more first base" conversation. Because if there's ever a time to see if Bruce can do that, now is the time. I get that.
Yeah.
I think it's a dumb idea at this point, because I think that just having Bruce on the team is a dumb idea, but he's a sunk cost and they're never going to move on from it, even though they should.
Right.
So, man, I just don't know. I just don't know what they're doing. I don't know why Alonso is not up. I don't know why Reyes is still getting starts.
There's so much to not know. I mean, isn't there always with this team?
Yeah, that is certainly the truth. So I kind of asked Jack this a few weeks ago. I kind of asked Allison this. I'll ask this to you now. Aside from just giving players some shots this September, is there anything you're hoping to see this September? Is there anything that stands out to you as a positive for the rest of the season?
DeGrom locking down the Cy Young, Wheeler sort of just continuing in this excellent groove that he's been in. To use one of Sandy Alderson's favorite phrases when he would speak, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. but really solidifying. I don't think there's necessarily a major freak out going on with Syndergaard, but there's a little bit of this of like, oh, is he actually good anymore? Or whatever. Hints of apprehension or skepticism, I guess, is how I would phrase it with him. I'd like to see him kick ass and, just have those three finish out the season strong. And, the new GM is going to have to make decisions about things, but one way they could signal that they mean business is by, extending at least two or maybe all three of those pitchers and guaranteeing that that's the foundation they have. There's some risk, of course, with anybody who you do that with. But strong performances from those three could go a long way toward making it seem like the 2019, I almost just said a year that was like 7 years ago. The 2019 rotation could be, good.
Yeah, I'll...
So that's it. I have no hope for the bullpen. There are plenty of people who I can root for, but there's nobody out there. Lugo has been great, Gazelman's been good, but of all the other arms of like, oh, maybe this guy could work. I guess Drew Smith has put up some good numbers. But,
I would say Smith and Bachelor are the two
that who have like your interest.
Yeah, those are guys that I'll pay attention to down the stretch. I think maybe could have a role in the bullpen next year. Almost everybody else, unfortunately, has not really done that.
Yeah.
I will add in things I want to see for the rest of the season. Obviously, you want to see guys like Conforto and Nimmo keep up their good seasons, just to give them the confidence they need, because the Mets are obviously a much better team with them than without them. So you want those guys to be as good as possible and to have all the confidences that the Mets won't fuck them up. I don't want anyone talking about why Bruce should be playing over either of those guys at all next season. And so,
yeah,
give them the proper number of at-bats to prove once and for all that they need to be starting every single day.
Yeah.
And then my last sort of hope, as I know one you share as well, is that Ahmed Rosario keeps up his hot streak he is going right now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. That's for sure. And McNeil, too.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
But yeah, Rosario in particular has finally, you know, looked like him. Well, himself isn't exactly what I meant, but, you know, the kind of hitter people thought he might be able to be. You know, it's important to remember he's still only 22. You know, not everybody comes up at 19 and kills it like Juan Soto.
Right.
You
yeah.
know?
Yeah, I feel like the Mets very quietly could have an infield of Todd Frazier and three young guys next year, all of whom are reasonably impressive. And that's not something I think any of us really expected at the start of... I think all of us expected by this point Dom Smith would be the starting first baseman, and we would have to lament that in our own ways.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny to think about it, and I'm not saying this is like a you know, World Series favorite type of, you know, roster, but you just look at the guys who might reasonably be pretty good, and you know, hey, if you had Alonzo, McNeil, Rosario, Frazier, and Frazier's been a little disappointing, but not like way out of whack with the kind of hitter that he usually
right.
is. But all right, you got those four guys. You got Conforto, Nimmo, Lagares, and Bruce. You know, there are flaws, so I'm not saying it's amazing, but you look at that and you go, you know, on an everyday basis, maybe we have position players everywhere who we're comfortable with. And, you know, if you can add somebody of a much greater magnitude like a Machado and you're willing to do that, then sure, let's have that conversation. But in a world where we don't expect the Mets to do anything even close to that, you know, there's a potential to have decent players, at least, at all of those positions.
Yeah.
You know, and I know this is like a rosy outlook, but if you have that, then you can hopefully focus on the rest of the rotation. You know, solidifying that, maybe finding a really good option at catcher to work with, I'd say, Plawecki at this point.
Yeah. Somebody pointed out, by the way, that if Frazier were to get hurt next year for a small period of time, you could theoretically have a starting nine on the Mets that all came through their farm system with an outfield of Nimmo, Lagares, and Conforto, Guillorme, Rosario, McNeil, and Alonso, and Plawecki behind the plate.
Yeah. Yeah, Guillorme or, you know, if Andrés Giménez starts to push his way up, he'd be another option to fill that in. But yeah, you know, that's definitely possible. Whether or not that's the best thing, I don't know.
Right, yeah, I have no idea at this
but
point.
It's cool when it happens. You know, it's one of those like novelty things in baseball that, you know, if things are going really well, you can be proud of it. And even if not, like, hey, this is kind of cool. But yeah, there's plenty of need to go around. So, you know, if you feel good about Nimmo, Conforto, Rosario, McNeil, and if they were just willing to give Alonso a spot on the 40, just to touch on that again, the most frustrating thing is that I know that they have to protect guys in the Rule 5 in the winter, and you know, they've got several 60-day DL guys who have to count against the 40 in the winter. So I know in their mind there's like a squeeze coming. But there's just so many guys on the 40 right now who you could DFA.
Without any consequence whatsoever.
Right. So, yeah, I just don't. I don't get it.
I mean, what's...
That should be the name of the podcast.
And what's there to get? You know, it's just... Okay, so let's... You and I have not talked since Dom Smith in left field cost DeGrom that game.
Oh, yeah. That was a thing.
Yeah, it was. Do you think that there's any space for Dom Smith on the Mets long term at this point?
based on everything that has played out with him, no, because I don't think they're going to give him any real shot. And I don't know that he would succeed with a real shot, but I don't even think they're going to give him one. And he's not an outfielder, you know? I mean, how many times can one franchise put guys in the outfield and set them up to fail?
Are you counting the rumors of them wanting to play Rosario in center field next spring?
Sure, yeah, we can throw that in there.
You might as well, right? If we're making a list here.
Yeah, I mean, and look, I'm not here to defend Jose Reyes at this point, but like, why was he in the outfield? And then, you know, the more infamous examples going back that everybody knows: Todd Hundley, Lucas Duda, Daniel Murphy. You know, like, you would think there would be some institutional acknowledgement that, hey, you know, outfield might seem easy, but it might not be easy for everybody.
And what's especially frustrating is, you know, right now, is that they have enough outfielders. They have too many outfielders. It's
right.
Even
it
worse.
Is the only. Yeah. So yeah, I don't know. I just don't see, you know, I could live with Alonso not getting called up a lot more if they said, we're giving Dom Smith the job every day in September. Because, you know, rather than like kind of putting little digs at Alonso's defense out there and, you know, whatever else they want to kind of generate in terms of doubt. And again, this is just, the team has terrible messaging. You know, make the baseball decision that you want Dom Smith to get a look for all of September, and then say, hey, we're not calling up Peter Alonso because we really want Dom to get these games in. We need to find out, you know, what we have in him. And, you know, if we call up Alonso, he's going to get a few pinch hitting appearances here and there. And, you know, that might not make Alonso any happier, but it's something people could at least go, okay, fine. You know, I can live with that because that's a better baseball reason than the one that you're giving
me. Right.
You know, that Wilmer Flores and Jay Bruce and, you know, whoever are all in the mix, and there's just not going to be enough playing time. So, yeah. Yep.
Yeah. It's getting to the point where there's almost no logic to their decisions whatsoever. There used to be a false logic to a lot of Mets decisions, where you could poke holes in them. But at this point, there are enough things that are happening that you just feel like, well, they have no fucking plan whatsoever here. This is this is completely inept from every perspective. I just don't know. I just don't know what. It's not good to be in the position the Mets are in right now and have no plan for September.
And with the messaging, the David Wright thing too, the things that the team has said, like just the weird way that they handled, you know, and they might not have even been trying to say something to like knock him down a peg, but, you know, to come out and say something about, him not being ready, we don't think he's ready, that kind of whatever that was. And then, you know, shortly after that, then it's, a couple of reporters are saying things about the insurance. And, you know, you had Mike Puma saying that he was getting a sense that it was, you know, really about insurance money and not wanting to pay David Wright. And, you know, David Lennon had tweeted, you know, by our calculations, you know, at Newsday, it would cost the Mets this if he plays, and, you know, this is what they'd save if he doesn't. And then, you know, all of a sudden, this is all out there, and it's like, oh, well, that's not, everybody thinks this all sounds terrible. So then it's like, oh, you know, David Wright will make that decision or whatever. You know, it just the way it kind of morphed.
It has to morph because they're so bad at this. Because they can't come up with one satisfactory answer, so they have to come up with five of them. And depending what who you get on which day, you get which answer.
Right. But yeah, so, you know, I was just thinking about it, and it was like, with the entire situation, rather than having sort of all this doubt lingering about everything that involves Wright, you know, from the get-go, they should have just been transparent. You know, this is his contract. excuse me. This is his contract. This is the percentage. Not even the percentage. This is the amount. He's owed this amount of money. If he doesn't play at all, this is what insurance covers. And we want you to know that. It breaks our heart that David Wright isn't on the field, because just like Mets fans, that's where we want to see him. And in his absence, we're going to do everything we can to make this a competitive team. And, like, I just thought of that.
Off the top of your head.
You know, right. Earlier today, talking to a friend who's a Mets fan, I came up with that as, like, a quote. And, you know, that it's better. And I know that convincing ownership to be transparent about the money is probably the biggest hurdle there. But, like, it got out anyway. Everybody knows basically what the math is. So just say it. Just say it. Those are like three sentences, and you put yourself in a much better spot that you don't come off as, you know, not being sympathetic or not knowing, you know, what's going on.
It just seems to me like for a player that has made them probably more money in jerseys and insert memorabilia sales here, you know, than any other player in their modern history, wouldn't you just eat the fucking insurance money? Come on.
You would hope.
Ugh. I guess let's just briefly touch on Zach Wheeler, because we were talking before the show about how we haven't talked about Wheeler in a little bit. Wheeler looks like he's legit right now. That's all I can really say. That's the only way I can say it. He looks more legit than he's looked ever.
Yep.
At this point, this is the longest sustained success he's had in, gosh, how many years?
I mean, it was 2014, you know, when he kind of had that really good run, and then he got hurt. And then he missed 15 and 16. 17 was weird. So, yeah, it's been a long time. And this is better than he ever looked during that stretch.
Yeah, I know we had sort of hemmed and hawed about that earlier in the season. You know, is this better than his 2014 season? I think now we can definitively say yes.
Yeah, for sure. So he's got the start on Friday night out in San Francisco, which is, you know, the last day of August. So what he does there will determine his ERA for the month. But going into it, he has a 1.09 ERA in August. And he's gone 7 innings, 4 out of 5 starts. And he hasn't given up more than 2 runs. And he only did that once in any of those starts. So this is a guy who's firing all cylinders. You know, I think I had looked at him before the starting as the Nationals, and just what he had been doing lately, you know, and he's been like, it's been a thing this year, checking in on what he's doing differently. And yeah, he's sort of, you know, he plateaued with velocity, which was inevitable because he was just throwing harder and harder and harder. And at some point that stops, but, you know, but he's still throwing as hard as he ever has. When you look at the average numbers, he sort of was mixing things up slightly. You know, he's been throwing that splitter that he developed earlier this season, kind of gotten away from throwing a changeup, you know, the pitch tracking stuff. And I didn't look at the most recent start, but the 4 previous starts, pitch tracking systems classified that, you know, he didn't even throw the changeup at all. So, you know, it's a pitcher who seems to be still improving. I mean, he had, at the end of June, he had a 4.47 ERA, and right now he has a 3.46. And if you do that in April, you can make a swing like that in a start.
Right.
But, when you're farther into a season, it's hard to cut a run off your ERA, or more than a run by 1/100th of a of an ERA. It just seems like physically his body was finally giving him its best possible performance. He's really run with it. And it's exciting to see, you know. I'm somebody who in mid-July, I was like, I don't know if I buy this. And I still don't know, how much you can count on him to make 30 starts in a given year. But, I went from trade him while his value is sky high to hold on.
Yeah.
If he's this good, don't trade him at all. You know, he's going to make nothing next year. And, if you're a team that's willing to pay good players, you can use that, sort of leverage. And I always root for the player. But from the team's perspective, Wheeler in arbitration is not going to make a ton of money next year. Even if you try to get him to sign an extension, you don't want to put too much risk into it. Some of the incentive for him could be, we're gonna pay you closer to the market rate next year, and then guarantee, two or three more years after that, whatever you want it, to be. And then you're not taking that much of a risk, and he's getting to a spot where, I don't think anybody's crying the blues for any salary. Excuse me. But, you have somebody who has been on the same team as Matt Harvey and saw everything that he's gone through. Maybe Harvey eventually refines himself. But this is somebody who's been a teammate of a guy who may never get a big payday.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's a unique position for everybody to be in here. But maybe a new GM blows it all up and trades all of these, three pitchers. But right now, I'm as high as I've ever been on Zach Wheeler. So that's a nice feeling.
Yeah, I don't think I disagree with anything you said there. It certainly makes me feel better about next season, because it seems like there's there's at least three starting pitchers that we can feel somewhat confident in. And by that, of course, I mean Wheeler, DeGrom, and Vargas.
Yeah.
Oh, boy, Vargas. What?
Yeah. Could you have picked a worse time to have, three good starts?
Yeah, exactly.
Couldn't you have done that in April and then fallen apart? We would have all liked that sequence a lot more.
Couldn't he have done it, the last start in June and his first two starts in July?
Right.
Come on now. Oh, boy, Vargas. Any other Mets-related ephemera you want to get to?
No, nothing specific. Just reminding everybody that we are going to try to do an in-person, everybody go to a game kind of thing. And stay tuned, next week-ish, because we're looking at late September. So hopefully we can just nail down a game and do the kind of thing that we've done in the past, get yourself into the ballpark on the cheapest ticket you can find, and then we'll pick a section and go to the standing room behind it.
I believe there's a promotion running right now for $25. You get a standing room ticket, a Shake Shack single burger, and a shake.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out whether or not that's a good deal.
Yeah, I couldn't figure it out either.
Compared to StubHub, the only thing is I don't know what the shake costs.
That's an excellent question.
I mean, they're not... Well, okay. they're aware that StubHub exists, and they know what their concessions prices are, right? So I think a $6 ticket on StubHub is 10 with fees. I know the single shack is like 7. So if the shake is $8, you're breaking even. If it's less than $8, then go the StubHub route and just buy the stuff yourself. And if it's more than $8, then you're actually getting a slight deal from the Mets.
Who'd have thunk that? A deal from the Mets.
But I don't know. I have no idea what a shake costs because, you know, I'm there to watch baseball and not take a nap.
Yeah, I refuse to wait for Shake Shack. I've never had Shake Shack in Citi Field.
Oh, wow. Oh, you got to get like a cheap Delta Club seat one night when it's, you know, mediocre weather and the season is lost. Or maybe just any game now the rest of the season where they deliver it to you. That's the best of both worlds.
I mean, I guess I'm that guy. Shake Shack burgers are good. I don't think Shake Shack burgers are the most wonderful things I've ever tasted in my life. And, yeah, I'm fine with getting it when I'm someplace that has a Shake Shack. I don't need to get it, at Citi Field.
Yeah.
Come at me, Burger Bros.
Well, you pitched the Shake Shack ticket.
I did. I was trying to entice our listeners to come out, not myself.
Yeah. Yes.
I don't need a reason to go to a Mets game.
Yeah, no, that's true. I'd like to think that we are the reason to go to the Mets game.
Oh, Chris. Sweet, naive, innocent Chris.
Sometimes.
<Yeah. laughs> No, it's, we should pick a game soon. But let's all hope that if we do pick a game, we pick a game David Wright plays.
Yes, absolutely.
Hey everybody, this is Steve Seiper, and I'm back to go over our minor league players of the week for week number 20 now. And I'm just going to quickly gloss over how the minor league affiliates did, because the season is pretty much over for most of them, and for a couple of them it actually is over, and I'll go into more detail about how they did at a later date. But basically, Las Vegas out, Binghamton out, St. Lucie out, Columbia out, Brooklyn is in, Kingsport is in, and GCL is out. So our pitcher of the week for this week is Brooklyn Cyclones right-hander Christian James. He pitched one game this week, and he went 8 innings, allowing no runs on just 2 hits. He did not walk anybody, and he struck out 4. So basically, in 2016, the Mets drafted and successfully signed 5 high school pitchers. Is Cameron Plank in the 10th round, Matt Cleveland in the 11th round, Christian James in the 14th round, Dariel Rivera in the 24th round, Eric Villanueva in the 30th round, and Garrison Bryant in the 36th round. Of all 5 of those guys, Christian James has had the best career by far. After being drafted, he was drafted out of East Lake High School in Florida. He tossed a couple of innings with the GCL Mets, and he posted a 0.52 ERA, allowing 11 hits, walking 5, and striking at 14. And he was assigned to Kingsport last season, and he had a solid year by any measure of the stick. He made 11 starts, and in them he posted a 4.18 ERA in 52.1 innings, allowing 54 hits, walking 16, and striking out 58. Now, because of his profile as a pitcher, and then the stats that he posted with Kingsport last year, we at Amazing Avenue named him the Mets' 20th top prospect. So James started the 2018 season at the end of May. He actually got a spot start for the Binghamton Rumble Ponies, and he did pretty well. He gave up a run over 4 innings. And then a week later, he made another spot start, this time for St. Lucie. And again, he pitched well. He gave up an unearned run over 5 innings. And then a few weeks later, he was named the opening day starter for the Brooklyn Cyclones. And through 12 starts now with Brooklyn, he has a 1.76 ERA in 66.2 innings, allowing 55 hits, walking 17, and striking out 40. Now, that ERA is actually second in the New York Penn League among qualified starters, Only his teammate Jason Valera has a lower ERA. His FIP, fielding independent pitching, is a bit higher. It's currently 4.05. Now, the main reason why there's such a huge difference between ERA and FIP is basically James's strikeout rate. He has a 15% strikeout rate this season, which comes out to a 5.4 strikeouts per 9 innings. Now, in roughly the same amount of time that he spent in Kingsport, he struck out 58 batters in 51.2 innings, which comes out to a 25.7 strikeout percentage, or 10.1 strikeouts per 9 innings. His walk rate and his home run rate are roughly the same, and it's really only the strikeouts that have dropped. And having seen James pitch this season, the drop in the strikeout rate is definitely tied to a pitching repertoire that's less than advertised, and definitely diminished in quality as compared to what it was. At the time when he was drafted, James had a fastball that sat in the high 80s to low 90s and topped out as high as 94. He had a loopy curveball in the high 60s, a sharper slider that was thrown in the high 70s, and a changeup. Now, having seen James pitch multiple times, and I'm talking like five this season, spread out over starts in June and July, basically his fastball is nothing like the one that he had when he was first drafted. In all those starts, it basically sat 88 to 90, and it touched 91 maybe a handful of times. The rest of the repertoire that he was using was more or less true to that information that I researched. Slider was 78 to 81, and definitely the best secondary that he threw. He used it mostly against right-handers down and away to get him fishing. His curveball was about 80 to 82, and it was really kind of a get-me-over pitch with just very, very light 12-6 break. And then his changeup was 83 to 85 and had slight arm-side fade. But that fastball really was very, very different from the one that he had when he was drafted. And in addition to having a lesser fastball, his command of the pitches just really hasn't been that great, be it intentional or unintentional. He throws too many unnecessary pitches. Basically, he nibbles around the strike zone, and he rarely challenges hitters. And in addition to that, as is the case with many pitches of his age, he kind of is reluctant to throw inside, and sometimes it seems like he almost pitches exclusively to the outer half of the plate. And that kind of stuff basically drives up his pitch count, and then when the pitch count is high, it limits his innings, and he basically has to be taken out of games, even when he is performing well. Now, the cause of his vanishing fastball is something that I really haven't been able to pinpoint. The right-hander, he did put on weight between 2017 and this year. He basically went from 195 to 210, so that's 15 pounds, and while 15 pounds really isn't necessarily anything major, he didn't put on good weight. It's mainly kind of concentrated in his midsection. I'm not saying he's fat. He's a little pudgy, maybe. You know, I am too. We all are at different times, but I'm not an athlete who's performing on one of the hardest places to perform. So basically, James's future value is going to really hinge on him recapturing that fastball velocity, honing his slider, which is his best secondary, and just working on his commands and improving that. Now, our hitter of the week for this week is Kingsport center fielder Jared Kelenic. He played in 7 games this week, and he hit 500, 567, 808, with 13 hits, 2 doubles, 2 home runs, 2 walks, 6 strikeouts, and 3 out of 3 stolen bases. So Kelenic is heating up at the right time, definitely, because coming into the week, the Kingsport Mets were basically in a virtual tie with the Bristol Pirates for the wild card spot, and then Kingsport swept the Pirates and gained a whole bunch of games on them. And Kelenic was a huge reason why. In those games against Bristol, in those 3 games, he went 7-for-11 with a double, 2 home runs, 2 hit-by-pitches, 5 runs scored, and 7 runs batted in. In addition to all that, or maybe because of all that, he was front and center in that drama between the two teams, where he was the guy that got hit after hitting a home run, and benches cleared, and a couple of managers got ejected. So he said of his hot streak, quote, doing what I've been doing, and I've been doing what I've been doing, and that's hit the ball hard, and they're just starting to find spots, which is great. I'm just trying to stick to the same plan, and that's barrel balls and be on time, end quote. Now, I just kind of quickly looked into the data, and he's not kidding. The balls are definitely falling in for hits and finding spots. He had a BABIP of 611 this week, as opposed to the 250 in his prior 35 games with Kingsport. Obviously, a 611 BABIP is unsustainably high, but at the same time, a 250 was a bit low for a hitter of his caliber. So, expect, there's not much left in the season now, obviously, but if there was, I think that we might be able to expect a normalization of that. So I made it down, actually, to Pulaski a couple of weeks ago to see Kingsport play, and thankfully Kalinic was in the lineup, and I would have seen him twice, but I kind of chickened out. I didn't want to drive home on I-81 through mountains and stressful driving on highways in the dark with no lights in a place I'm not familiar with, so I left early, and I skipped that second game, but I did get to see him, and he went 1-for-4 with a walk, a strikeout, and a stolen base, and the bat looked good. It's quick, and he gets hard contact, so when he starts learning to lay off stuff that he can't drive, and he starts recognizing off-speed pitches a little better, he's going to have a pretty potent bat. But between the swing and his natural strength, there's definitely above-average power in there. And while neither the hit tool nor the power tool are, like, off the charts, they do complement each other. And he's probably not going to develop into, like, a batting champion or a home run king or anything like that. But hopefully he should develop into a guy that could post relatively high batting averages with moderate power. Now, the defense was actually a little better than I thought it would be. When he was drafted, there were questions about whether or not he'd be able to stay in the center field. And at the time, I was one of the people that were leaning on the side if he could. And having seen him play center, I think barring a lot of bad weight, I see no reason why he won't be able to handle it. He's very athletic, and actually his defense reminded me a bit of Carlos Beltran. A bit. Obviously, there are very few center fields out there that are like Carlos Beltran. But it was basically like the professionalness and demeanor of him in the outfield is what made me think of Beltran. Every catch he made, it didn't seem like urgent. It didn't seem like he had to rush to the ball and get there or just a moment to spare. All the catches that he made were like nonchalant almost. You know, he read the ball off the bat well. He just kind of glided over. He has above average speed, so he's quick. And, you know, he just made the catches with no problem. And then after the game, I found this a little, not odd, but it just something that stuck with me. He was definitely definitely getting chewed out by Sean Ratliff, the manager of Kingsport. And he singled in his last at-bat. He drove a 1-2 pitch down the middle into center field, so I'm not exactly sure what the conversation was about. By the time I was able to, like, you know, get kind of close, and this was after the game while everybody was leaving, it had kind of just turned into a regular conversation. But Ratliff kind of looked heated. But like I said, I don't know what they were talking about, but I've heard rumblings that Kalinic is kind of a passionate kid, a fiery kid. So it'll be interesting to see going forward if, you know, there's anything to that. I'm not going to say, you know, if are there behavioral issues or, you know, he does things on the field or in the dugout that gets other teams pissed off at him or stuff like that. But, you know, he was just drafted now, so we'll see if, that kind of becomes a thing. Hopefully not. But I do know that this winter it's going to be pretty tough ordering Kalinic, Vientos, and Newton when we start making our top 25 lists. So, I am Steve Saipa, and I will be back next week with a very, sad, I guess, minor league update, because the seasons are pretty much over. But until then...
Hello, Mason Avenue podcast friends. Allison McCaig here with another episode of the DeGrometer and the Mnemometer, where we track two of our favorite Mets performances this year, Jacob DeGrom and Brandon Nimmo. So we'll start with Jacob DeGrom and his quest for the Cy Young. Since I last spoke to you guys, he's had two starts. Last Thursday, he matched up against the Giants and Madison Bumgarner, which is obviously a tough matchup for anyone. He went six innings. He gave up four hits and two runs, but only one of those was earned because he was let down by his defense as usual. Uncharacteristically, he walked four batters, which is not usual for him. But even though he didn't really have his best command all day, he still struck out 10 batters, which is, you know, a testament to how good he really is, the fact that he didn't really feel his greatest, especially about his fastball, but he still struck out 10 guys. But, you know, against Madison Bumgarner, that wasn't good enough. Bumgarner just out-dueled him. He went eight innings and only gave up one run on five hits. So DeGrom got the loss in that start, unfortunately. But his ERA was still fine at that point. It was 1.71. It pretty much stayed the same from the previous start to that one. And then DeGrom pitched again on Tuesday against the Cubs. He went eight innings. He was pushed to 109 pitches, but, you know, he really gutted it out at the end despite giving up a run in the seventh inning. That run was earned, but it was really due to a defensive miscue by Jay Bruce. He let a sharp grounder off the bat of Ben Zobrist go, like, right under his glove, which sent Kyle Schwarber, who had hit a single, to third, and then Bodie hit a sacrifice fly, and that was the only run. But DeGrom drove in the only run that the Mets scored. So at that point, it was 1-1. DeGrom only walked one batter, and he struck out 10 again. He was pumping 100 on the gun, which was amazing to watch. But of course, the Mets couldn't score for him. He drove in the only run, and the game remained tied after nine innings, at which point the rains came, and they had to resume the game the next day, and then the Mets were walked off in the 11th, the following morning. Early afternoon, rather. On the season to date, he has thrown 182 innings pitched in 27 starts. He is 8-8, a very unfortunate record for someone as good as him. We all know this. With a 1.68 ERA, which leads the league by a pretty significant margin at this point. Second place is Aaron Nola with a 2.10, so that leads him by 0.42. He has a 0.98 whip, which is behind Scherzer's 0.88 whip, but right there with Nola's 0.97 whip. His 2.03 FIP leads the three major Cy Young candidates. He leads Nola by a significant margin in that category, leads Nola by almost 0.6, and he has a 5.46 strikeout to walk ratio on the season, which is obviously incredible too. As far as WAR is concerned, DeGrom is ahead in Fangraphs WAR by a significant margin. He has 7.3 Fangraphs WAR, while Scherzer and Nola have 5.8 and 5.7 FWAR, respectively. Baseball Reference WAR is another story. DeGrom is consistently third there. He consistently seems to lead in FWAR, but trail in BWAR. As far as WAR goes and Baseball Reference for all, Nola is the leader with 8.9, and Scherzer's right with him at 8.8, and then DeGrom trails a little bit by 8.2. But if you do Baseball Reference WAR for pitchers, which takes into account defensive support and adds value for high leverage situations, Nola gets a huge boost because, like DeGrom, he plays behind a really crappy defense. So Nola has 9.2 Baseball Reference WAR for pitchers, and then Scherzer and DeGrom trail him by a full win. So Scherzer's at 8, and DeGrom's at 7.9. But keep in mind that DeGrom gets dinged in these WAR calculations a little bit, especially in BWAR for park factors, because Citi Field has been rated consistently as, like, the best pitcher's park the whole season. But, you know, DeGrom has also performed perfectly admirably on the road, so make of that what you will. I still think, you know, as far as the Cy Young goes, DeGrom is clearly the best pitcher in the National League. He leads in all the major categories. It really just depends on what you favor. If you're talking about ERA, which is really, when it comes down to the bare bones of it, the pitcher's job is to not give up runs, and DeGrom's been the best at that, period. If you favor more traditional metrics like wins, Scherzer's got the edge, and Scherzer's got the edge, and he strikes out more guys, too, and he's going to end up with the most innings pitched, probably, of the three. If you really favor baseball reference WAR, that's really the only place Nola has the edge over the other two, but Nola's a legit contender. He's passed Scherzer in the ERA race now as well, so... They're all three really great pitchers. I still think DeGrom's the best pitcher. He also leads in ERA plus, if you favor that metric. So it really depends on what metrics you look at. But ERA, pure and simple, DeGrom's way ahead. Let's shift gears and talk about Brandon Nimmo. He's back from the disabled list. He came back on Tuesday after missing 12 games with a bruised finger after being hit by that pitch, but luckily nothing was broken on the x-ray or the MRI, so he only had to miss 12 games. So he played Tuesday and yesterday, so that's his only stats for this week. For Tuesday's game, which obviously resumed yesterday, he had 5 at-bats over those 2 days and went 1-for-5 with a single, and he struck out 3 times. So unfortunately, it kind of seemed like at that point, like, oh no, is he going to go into another slump, another struggle after being hit by a pitch again? But encouragingly, in the regularly scheduled game yesterday, he fared much better. He had a 3-hit day in the Mets 10-3 win, and one of those 3 hits played it a run. So that was good to see. But obviously the whole offense suddenly woke up since DeGrom wasn't pitching. But, you know, it's encouraging to see that hopefully Brandon Nimmo isn't going to have another slump, and he'll keep going right where he left off. So, on the season to date, Brandon Nimmo's had 423 plate appearances, and he's slashing .268, .388, .500, with 15 home runs, 65 runs scored, 40 RBIs, and 8 stolen bases. He has a .148 OPS plus, which is third in the entire National League, behind only Matt Carpenter and Eugenio Suarez. OPS plus is adjusted for ballpark, so conversely, Jacob DeGrom gets dinged a lot in the adjusted metrics because Citi Field is a pitcher-friendly park, but this helps out Brandon Nimmo a lot, so his OPS plus is really high up there in the National League, and he's ahead of Freeman, he's ahead of Nolan Arenado, he's ahead of Baez, a lot of guys that are in, you know, the discussion for the NL MVP. So that's just, you know, something to put on his record, the fact that he has such good numbers. His 145 WRC plus is second among NL outfielders, ranked only behind Christian Yelich, so that's also impressive. He has 3.5 Fangraphs WAR, as well as 3.5 Baseball Reference WAR. And as far as Fangraphs WAR goes, that is fourth in among NL outfielders, behind only the likes of Yelich and Kane. So he, you know, even though he doesn't get talked about a lot when it comes to the conversation among the best position players in the National League, his numbers are up there, and he doesn't get a ton of respect because he's not a very well-known player. He's a, you know, a new player, but something to keep an eye on as his career moves forward. It's something really promising. The Fangraphs wrote an article the other day entitled "The Mets Finally Freed Brandon Nimmo." So, you know, that tells you all you need to know. The Mets hadn't freed Brandon Nimmo before now. This season, a combination of seeing how good he is and injuries allowed him to really get the bulk of the playing time out there in the outfield, and he has proven that he is indeed an everyday player. So that's something to pencil in for 2019, Brandon Nimmo, starting outfielder. So that's all I have for you this week for the DeGrometer and the Nimmometer. Looking forward to giving you guys another rendition next week, where hopefully Jacob DeGrom will get a win.
That does it for another installment of Amazing Avenue Audio. Thank you so much for joining us. We truly appreciate it. Go to AmazingAvenue.com where you can check out all the Mets news and goings-on, both from folks on this podcast and from folks you haven't met yet on the podcast. But hopefully this offseason we'll actually have a lot more staff stopping by the podcast, so look forward to that. You can get this podcast, the show you're listening to right now, from BlogTalkRadio.com or from Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice. If your podcatcher of choice allows you to rate, review, and subscribe, please do so. We truly appreciate that. You can send us emails, at least for the time being, at podcast@amazingavenueaudio.com. New email forthcoming, I promise. And you can follow all of us on Twitter. I am at Brian Needs an App. Chris is at Chris McShane. Allison is at Petite PhD. And Steve is at Steve Saipa. So, the Mets are currently in the West Coast. Let's hope they continue their somewhat winning ways there. And until next time, let's go Mets.